Not a glitch in our news.
We're back. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Do I need to start over, or can we continue from where we were?
We should be okay.
Okay. Thank you. I believe I was just describing my typical commute from Southeast Portland to downtown Portland across the Hawthorne Bridge. And often when I commute, I've got my clothes for the day in one bag. I've got my laptop. I've got a number of books. I've got binders. I have two heavy panniers on the side of my bike as I cycle to work. I've got my helmet. I've got my rain gear on often. It's a commute that I enjoy, but it is not always the easiest thing to do, to get up every morning and do. It is frequent that I am behind a bus, that I am dodging car doors that are opening on the side as I try to stay out of the flow of traffic, that I'm breathing exhaust. And what this bill does is tries to recognize that we have an ability to get more people onto bicycles by making it easier for bicycles to be off the main drag, to be on back streets, to use areas where there might be more stop signs in a way that doesn't require them to come to a full dead stop at every stop sign. Now, I want to clarify a couple of things about this bill. The right-of-way does not change with this bill. We are not giving bicycles impunity to blow through stop signs. We are not legalizing bad behavior here. What we are doing is we are decriminalizing good behavior. And the point of this bill is to allow cyclists to approach an intersection slowly, to slow down, to yield the right-of-way, to check for oncoming traffic, and then proceed through the intersection without coming to a complete dead stop and putting a foot down. And as you'll hear from a number of people who are testifying today, there are studies to back this up. There is a lot of experience in other places with this kind of law, and it's a question of physics as well. So what we are here talking about today is the responsible use of bicycles as an alternative form of transportation that can help build the economy and help us with our carbon footprint, and how to use them in a safe way. And as a final note, before I turn it over to the likely many people that would like to testify on this, I have heard some concerns back that perhaps we have not clearly defined enough what slow down and yield the right-of-way means in the bill. I'd be open to ideas and suggestions on how best to accomplish this. Again, the intention is to require cyclists to cycle in a responsible manner and in one that reflects the realities of bicycling.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you. I have a number of questions, and probably you aren't the answerer of them. But I wondered if... I mean, I've heard of a California stop, and now I know an Idaho stop. I feel like I've learned something already today. When you developed this bill, is this language from Idaho statute, or did you go with an idea they had in Idaho and put it in your own statutory? Do you understand the difference? Did you model this after the Idaho language?
Chair Beyer, Representative Berger. Let me start answering that question by saying, to my best of my knowledge, the California stop principle doesn't.
It's an in statute, I don't think.
Yeah, I believe it's not actually legal in California. The Idaho stop is actually legal in Idaho. I'm not sure, but to your point, the subsequent folks who will be giving testimony will be able to address that. Not actually craft the legislation.
Thank you.
Representative Call.
I just wanted to thank you, Representative Bailey, for bringing this bill. I was somebody who hadn't seen the light on this, actually, until this weekend, and there were two things that brought me into the fold. One was a conversation with my brother-in-law, who supported the bill, and I was really surprised, and he said, the only thing more annoying than being trapped behind a bicycle is being trapped behind a bicycle who is faithfully obeying all the laws. So... That was one point. Another one is actually this weekend I bought a new bike, and I went for a test ride down by Bike and Hike on MLK, and I counted how many times I didn't come to a complete stop, and it was a staggering number considering how short that test drive was. So I think I'm in full support of this bill now.
Representative Widener.
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey.
I, as you probably have heard, have some serious concerns about this bill. I teach my kids when they're walking to stop and look both ways. I teach my kids that they need to make sure no cars are coming. And allowing them or making it legal for them to blow through stop signs, I don't think is a good precedence for us to be setting. Yeah, it's more annoying. It's annoying when you're in a car and have to come to a complete stop. I hit four-way stops out in the middle of nowhere that I don't like having to stop at because I know no one's going to be there, but I do it because it's the law. And I'm just worried about children and what kind of precedence we're setting for kids because I chew out a lot of kids right now. I just chewed out my own kid for going down the sidewalk and going through a street the other day that I watched. So I'm a little nervous on this whole bill and what we're going to do with children because the last thing I want to do is vote on a piece of legislation that could actually create an environment where a child could die. So because this doesn't affect just adult riders, this affects everybody in our communities, and this is a very serious bill we're dealing with here.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I appreciate your concerns, and it does my heart glad to know that you're teaching responsible traffic safety to your children. A small point of clarification, this bill does not allow cyclists to blow through stop signs, and in fact, I would argue that, with all due respect, that it does much of what I believe that you're teaching your children to do, which is to approach an intersection carefully and to yield the right of way and to check for oncoming traffic. And my intention in this bill and the authors of the bill, I believe, would not disagree with you that is an appropriate practice to continue teaching our children and for everybody to obey.
Thank you. Okay, come in. Who knows when I'll be back? Anything else you need to? Yeah.
I'm right here, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Madam Chair, ask him if he's from the BPA, and I have other questions.
From the BPA.
From the BPA.
If you're from the BPA.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then now I will call Carl Rohde, and is it the next two names on the list?
No.
Okay, and that's Bob Mionski and Ray Thomas, and hopefully close here. Welcome.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you, this time in support of House Bill 2690, also known as the Idaho Stop Law. For the record, I'm Carl Rohde, Government Relations and Public Affairs Director for the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. We are a statewide advocacy organization of more than 5,000 members, and we've been at this for nearly 20 years in terms of bicycle advocacy, and we're recognized, in fact, as a national leader in the terms of bicycle advocacy and as well as teaching children how to bike safely. We have taught over 50,000 children in the state of Oregon bike safety in the various schools that range everywhere from Baker to Coos Bay and Portland down to Medford. We're in virtually all the larger cities in the state. So we firmly believe that this law is actually in the best interest of all road users. And the BTA, as an organization, is deeply, deeply committed to the safety of bicyclists. And we would never, in fact, support a bill that we felt in any way would jeopardize that safety. This bill, as Representative Bailey said, does not decriminalize bad behavior. It decriminalizes good behavior that everyone who has ever been on a bike has engaged in. The bad behavior will still be against the law, and we, in fact, as an organization, will continue to work in a cooperative manner with law enforcement to ensure that they have the opportunity to enforce the law so that those cyclists who are blowing through stops without any regard for the right-of-way of other users of the road are the people that are actually punished and not the family or the person like Representative Bailey that is traveling to work in the morning that doesn't come to a complete foot-down stop at every stop sign gets a $240 ticket. Most cyclists, in fact, have a high degree of self-preservation and are not going to engage in unnecessarily dangerous behavior. By their very nature, the cyclists have a higher degree of awareness of their surroundings. They sit up higher. They have no blind spots. Because they are not encased in a vehicle, they actually have a greater sense of hearing of what's taking place around them. And there's more information in the voluminous packet of information I gave you from a researcher in California that has extensively looked at this issue. His name is Jason Meggs, and he goes into greater detail about the sensory awareness of a cyclist as they are traveling on the road being equal to that of a pedestrian that is traveling down the street. Existing law is a discouragement to cycling. Around 60% of the public is interested in cycling but have concerns about the convenience and the safety of it. They would prefer to ride on low-volume, low-traffic streets, the residential streets. However, in the interest of traffic calming, those streets are often loaded with stop signs. And the reason for this is to discourage motorists from cutting through neighborhoods and avoiding the major arterials. So we have put stop signs all over our residential areas to make it a less convenient environment for motorists. But this, in fact, is just the place that the average bicyclist would prefer to be riding as opposed to be riding down a major arterial street or a state highway in Oregon. So you put the citizen in a very odd position where they are having to choose, okay, do I feel safer by riding in the neighborhood, but it's so inconvenient because I'm coming to a stop at every single intersection and putting my foot down, or do I throw caution to the wind and go and ride out onto the major arterial with amongst all of the traffic, and which is too scary for them to maybe even continue to do, or you put them in the position of saying, well, I'm going to ride through the neighborhoods. I'm not going to come to a complete stop. I'm just going to be an outlaw. And this is what you're asking Oregonians to make that choice on a daily basis when they make the choice to ride bicycles. The original concept of this bill, we included a provision that would have allowed jurisdictions to, in fact, designate certain extreme hazard intersections to require a complete stop. There are some of those that may be necessary. We were informed by legislative counsel that because such a sign does not exist in the manual on uniform traffic control devices, that they can't draft legislation allowing for the use of a sign that is not currently legal. So it was not in there. And I hope that if that is continues to be a concern, that we might be able to address it as we move forward with this bill. There were the issue of I just wanted to address briefly on teaching kids. We have a nationally recognized curriculum on teaching kids bike safety, and it involves the issue of pedestrians. And in as much as I, as a child, was taught to stop at intersections and look both ways before I cross the street, now as an adult, the law does not obligate me to stop at an intersection and look both ways before I cross the street. Therefore, I don't. As I approach the intersection, I can assess whether or not it is safe for me to cross, and I don't come to a complete stop before I go across that street. I think that we can engage in the same kind of safety teaching for children as we do on for child bicyclists as we do for child pedestrians. We can tell them, actually, you need to come to a stop and move, and then proceed through. And when you're old enough to actually know better, then you can walk across the street or bike across the street without coming to a complete stop. Joining me today are Attorney Ray Mayonsky, Attorney Ray Thomas, and Corvallis resident Chris Worlow will be coming up after that to tell a little bit about their experience with this law. I really, really appreciate the attention that has been given to this. We have spent over a year interviewing people in Idaho, meeting with law enforcement, meeting with legislators to try and get the best possible information on this issue so that you can have the most information at your disposal when not only considering the decision on your own, but also when discussing it with your constituents, as I'm sure that you have already received one or two calls this afternoon as a result of coverage in our local newspaper. So I hope that I can answer any further questions that you may have, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
I have Schaffler and Berger and Edwards.
Only to say, Madam Chair, not as many phone calls and emails as I did on a $54 tax on bicycles.
Chair Beyer, Representative Schaffler, I can assure you that the BTA was not encouraging people to call your office on that issue.
Talk about that later, Carl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of specific questions, and I don't know whether you're the one to answer. But you heard my previous question,
yes,
which is where the language of the origin. I presume somebody is going to tell me that at some point. Here's a couple of others that I'm going to throw out there that I'd kind of like to hear. Not too far from here is a bike lane that has an actual bike lane stop sign on it.
Mm-hmm.
Would those be, in other words, they could blow by those too? And the reason that this is, under this statute, could they slow Idaho stop on those too? And the reason I ask is that as a driver, I'll see that and say, oh, they're going to stop, I have right away. And it scares me to think that they might not stop at a stop sign that is a bicycle stop. So I'd like that addressed. I'd also like to talk about, I've seen them and they scare me to death, these bike boxes in Portland and how those work. As someone who doesn't frequently drive, I actually am in Portland quite a bit, but not in the areas, but I've come on them and gone, oh yeah, there's a whole new set of rules here and how do they apply and what do I do and I don't want to be, you know. So again, how would those work with this? Those are questions.
Okay, the Chair Beyer, Representative Berger, I appreciate that, and I apologize for not answering your first question in my opening statement. But in fact, the language that we used here was we took from the bill that was passed in the House in 2003 that was introduced by then Representative Przanski, and that passed 47-9, and there were 4 absences on that vote. So we brought that language forward. It is based on the Idaho Stop Law, but for instance, the Idaho Stop Law includes that bicyclists can treat a stop light as a stop sign. They can actually come to the stoplight, look both ways. If there's no cars coming, go across the street. We determined that it was not in the best interest to proceed with that. And in fact, I understand that Idaho's motivation was a fiscal one in that they did not want to be having to replace the sensors in intersections all over Idaho to identify bicyclists waiting at stoplights, and they figured rather than put a bicyclist in a position of having to wait either break the law or wait for a car to come up behind them to trigger the sensor, that they would do this. So it was largely a fiscal issue. On the issue of the bike lane stop sign, that would actually have the same rules apply as this law would propose. And I want to make it very clear that the law does not at all condone anyone blowing through a stop sign. And we're very concerned that the image of the scofflaw cyclist not looking either way and blowing through a stop sign is what we're trying to legalize here. No, in fact, those people will still be criminals, and those people we will work with law enforcement to ensure that they are punished by this law, which is actually a 50% increase in the current fine for someone that does not come to a complete stop at the stop sign. Bike boxes are a unique issue in Portland. They actually only appear at stoplights, and so this law would not apply. But for elucidation on the issue, that you come to a stop where the stop bar is, and the idea is that the cyclist can ride up out of your blind spot, so that they're up there in the right-hand side instead of off to your side. And then it also makes, of the 14 intersections where they've done it in Portland, it illegal to turn right on red. So that way, when the light turns green, the cyclist can clear the intersection quickly, and the driver can proceed and either turn right or continue on.
Okay. Representative Edwards, and then Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the impetus behind the bill, but do have some questions about the implementation. I mean, to my mind, traffic laws are designed to ensure certainty. And the way I read the bill introduces a level of uncertainty in how other folks are going to use the road. In your presentation, you brought up the notion of pedestrians. And if I use an analogy, I mean, why Would you advocate a law that would allow pedestrians to essentially slow and go? I mean, if there's no one at the intersection, why should they bother to obey the crosswalk sign?
Chair, by Representative Edwards, the law currently allows a pedestrian to approach an intersection and continue across the intersection if they are not, and in fact gives them a little bit more. They always have, the pedestrian always has the right of way. So current law does not require pedestrians to come to a stop at stop signs.
Follow up?
Oh, please.
I would just say that as someone who has received a jaywalking ticket, that it still introduces a level of uncertainty in terms of cases in which you can apply that particular rule, and I think that this bill has the potential to introduce that same level of uncertainty.
I knew there was a dark side to him, Madam Chair.
Just to clarify, I didn't receive that ticket here in Oregon. I received it in California.
Chair, by our Representative Edwards, the uncertainty that would be provided by this for law enforcement would actually be no more uncertain for law enforcement when they are enforcing an existing yield sign on a public right-of-way anywhere in the state.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm with Representative Edwards on a lot of this stuff. When I'm reading the language, it's like we're making two sets of rules, and you're on the streets with the automobiles. And I think this is an issue we had even in Portland with the bikers who got ran over by the truck drivers riding up in that box. Me, as when I'm in the car, I know, hey, his blinker's on. I need to stay back because he's making a right-hand turn. And now that we've set that box up there, they can still get up, and you don't know if you have eye contact with that truck driver or not. And now we're creating another set of rules here where automobiles are going to have troubles not hitting bikers. And it's gets to be a very scary situation. I don't know how you feel about two sets of rules on the road, but I think we're creating a big problem by introducing two sets of rules on the road.
Chair Beyer, Representative Widener, there are actually multiple instances in law in which there are two sets of rules for different types of vehicles. For instance, in certain areas, a bicyclist can ride their bike on the sidewalk, but in fact, you would never allow a car to do the same. There are areas where, in certain situations, bicyclists are allowed to pass on the right, but you do not allow that for automobiles. We believe that this actually creates a more expected behavior on the road as a result of folks that are approaching an intersection and, like a pedestrian, for instance, not coming to a complete stop, but have already assessed whether or not it is safe. The right-of-way law does not change whatsoever. Bicyclists are still going to be obligated to give right-of-way to people in an intersection, and they are still going to be obligated to give right-of-way to pedestrians. The certainty, I think, is that you will no longer have to come to a complete foot-down stop at every single stop sign that you encounter in your ride. So if you're traveling through areas of Newburgh or other parts of the state, and you're traveling by George Fox College, for instance, or something to that effect, then, in fact, you're not going to have to come to a stop at some of these small residential streets that have very little traffic. If you're traveling in Elgin, for instance, you're not going to have to come to a stop when you can see for 20 miles in each direction that, in fact, there are no cars coming. But right now, under the current law, if you don't come to a complete stop, you are violating the law and you are an outlaw. And we just feel that that is a little too extreme for an activity that we're trying to encourage.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
My concern isn't in Elgin or around George Fox College. My concern is downtown Salem, downtown Portland, the side roads there, because there is more traffic. And as you get comfortable riding through these, I mean, you made the comment that it's almost their choice to either be an outlaw or not be an outlaw. It's the same thing with cars and also with motorcycles when you're riding on the back streets. You know, how much do I slow down and yield? And that's why we have accidents even with automobiles on the back and side streets. So if you get a car that's blowing through and then a bicycle is just coming to a quick stop, they're going fast. I mean, these bikes you guys are doing 30 miles an hour and you slow down to 10, how do we let the officer determine what's in a reasonable slowdown? So, and those are questions that are fairly tough to address. And the problem is we don't find out until after the accident's occurred. That's when we know if somebody's been slowing down or not. not usually beforehand. So, and the language isn't clear on how slow is slow enough.
Mm-hmm. Chair, by Representative Widener, that is definitely something that Representative Bailey addressed as something we might need to have a greater discussion on how slow is slow enough, and we're willing to have that conversation to see whether or not we can achieve a rational expectation of what that might be. We feel that cars do present a much greater hazard on the road than a bicycle does. And a bicycle who is going to blow through a stop sign at 30 miles per hour is likely placing themselves in far greater danger than they are the operator of the motor vehicle. And thus we have over 40,000 people a year dying in automobile-related crashes. And that's why we actually more heavily regulate the automobile than we might the bicycle, because there are certain inherent safety aspects to a bicycle that might not be achieved with an automobile.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've got two bills here that you have asked for us to be introduced.
Yes.
And it seems like they kind of go against each other. You're asking for one to be able to go through a stop sign, and then the other bill we'll be hearing today asks for lighted signals that will be like traffic lights, only they'll be for bicycles, and red, green, and yellow with the same purpose, et cetera. So what would happen if we did that and then this bill, too?
Chair Beyer, Representative Boone, what would happen there is that cyclists would have to come to a complete stop at bicycle lights, and that's why the bill that we introduced earlier, in fact, defines that behavior, that if you approach a bicycle light, then you have to, and it's red, then you will have to come to a complete stop. You would not have the option of engaging the Idaho stop law and proceeding through in a safe speed. In fact, you would have to come to a complete stop in those instances.
Follow up. And I know this is probably for the next bill, but why would you do that? Why would you have a parallel set of lights?
Chair by Representative Boone, there might be instances. For instance, the one in Portland that is most well known by folks there is a four-way intersection with a light, and the cyclist coming off of the East Bank Esplanade is coming this direction, and they want to get over to the bicycle lane that's over on this side. And so what this does is actually stops all traffic going either direction, and then this light allows cyclists to proceed on green to cross diagonal across the intersection in order to get back into the bike lane without necessarily having to go across one and across another in order to get there. So there are unique circumstances to each city in Oregon that might apply for why they would want that piece of equipment in their city, but we feel that it would have the same force of law that stoplight was, and the Idaho stop law as proposed does not allow cyclists to proceed on a red.
Final follow-up.
Yes.
It seems to me that until we do what they do in Europe, and that is have a separate, divided off the street place for bicycles to ride, this is a little confusing, because when I read this law and look at the existing law, and I read that bicyclists are supposed to, or this is what, maybe I'm just too old, you know, but I have, in my district, most of the stop lights, we don't have stop lights except in the cities, but the stop signs are from one highway to another highway, and these are high-speed highways. And I can't imagine someone coming up Highway 53 in my district, coming onto 26, and trying to make that bump when you've got a blind curb coming this way and you can only see this, and these are usually groups of bikers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all going 30 miles an hour because they got to make that bump. And they're coming like this. They've got traffic turning and stuff. Having seen some of the messes I have from the view of the fire department, it's a little scary for me. And I don't know how you would approach that. I would hope that you would all stop at those kinds of stops.
Yes, Chair Beyer, Representative Boone, this is not intended for the situation on a highway, for instance, and I'm not sure whether or not in that situation, if they're traveling on to Highway 26, if they are encountering a stop sign,
just a stop sign.
Then they would have to slow to a speed that they would not put themselves in jeopardy or take over the right-of-way of people traveling on Highway 26. If they failed to come to a speed, to come to slow to a speed that they could not come to a complete stop, they would be in violation of this law, and therefore they would be ticketed $360 and told you probably should be a little safer on the road in the future. A lot of this also addresses kind of the urban areas where you have a gridded street network, for instance, that has low-volume streets and then high-volume streets, and this gives the cyclist an opportunity to choose the low-volume streets again without necessarily having to come to a stop at every single intersection, because that is a very difficult situation for a lot of cyclists.
I just have one more tiny one. Have you gone to the city council and tried to do it that way? It seems like this is a city issue then.
Chair by Representative Boone, we did not feel that cyclists should experience something completely different when they're traveling from Portland into Gresham or from Portland into Lake Oswego. But in fact, this should be just a recognized element of law around the state, and this seems to have worked well for over a quarter century in the state of Idaho. I think we're, as I put in my frequently asked questions, just hoping for Oregon to become as progressive as Idaho on this issue.
Representative Benson, then Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's your turn.
Since I live in Ontario and I have occasion to drive through Idaho, I think the reason they have the laws is there's only two bicyclists in the entire state. I may be off by a couple. It seems to me that I hope I have captured this correctly, that there is the point of this is to make it easier, and we want to encourage folks to ride bicycles. And thus, we are going to, or you're suggesting a change in the law that we hope wouldn't make it more dangerous for folks to ride bicycles. But the ultimate foundation of what you're asserting is that we want more people to ride bicycles, I think. I think that's the justification. And so I'm going to ask you to explain to me, since we want to encourage electric cars, and some of them only go 35 miles an hour, can we expand your bill to include electric cars?
Chair Beyer, Representative Bentz, I think that the Bicycle Transportation Alliance is strictly interested in the interests of bicycling, and we would be happy to invite the AAA to come in and talk about something like that. But I'm fairly positive that those two cyclists in Ontario will be giving you a call on it. So we'll we've got some
follow up.
Actually, I did contact some of the bicyclists in Ontario and asked them about the Idaho law. Now you mentioned it, and they indicated that they tended to be more careful in Oregon for fear of the ticket, and they would still roll through a lot of stop signs in Oregon, but they would roll through them more quickly in Idaho. And to me, that indicated that it was probably more dangerous to be a bicyclist in Idaho. But my question to you is, really, I would like you to just define for me the difference between a bicyclist on the one hand and the electric car on the other. I mean, why should we carve out an exception for one and not the other? In fact, and just to add to that, I think the people in the electric car are safer because they're in a car.
Yes. Chair Beyer, Representative Bentz, I love to be able to get to all the questions on these, but I also, my two hired experts, or not my hired experts, but these two folks are really chomping at the bit to be able to answer a lot of the legal questions and issues such as that, and I'd be happy to respond if there are any questions that they can't answer. But thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bailey, and then I guess we probably should let some of these other people talk, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the Chair's indulgence, I'd like to take just a moment to respond to both Representative Boone and Representative Bentz's questions with a comment that reflects my personal experience. And I actually would disagree a little bit with Carl. I don't believe that the foundation of this is just to encourage cycling. I believe that this is also about safety and responsible use of the road. And in a situation in which you have a low-volume street or even a high-volume street that intersects with a high-traffic street, and maybe not in the case of highways, but let's say, for example, if I need to cross 7th Avenue and there are cars coming, I find that coming to a dead stop makes it very difficult to get going quickly from that intersection to be able to dodge and get across the intersection in a safe manner. I'm very slow when I start out, and it's difficult to time how far cars are coming. But if you're able to look and see and slow down, you aren't starting from that dead stop every single time when you come out into an intersection. Not that I ever engage in outlaw behavior. But I would say to your question, the difference with an electric car is that an electric car is fundamentally part of a transportation system that was built to accommodate cars. We have rules that recognize how and when it is safe for a car to proceed, where they can best operate. And an electric car is not fundamentally different in that regard than in many ways than a gasoline-powered car, at least my understanding. So a bicycle is to me a fundamentally different kind of transportation.
Thank you, and we'll go ahead and move on. So.
Chair Byard, members of the committee.
Pull a microphone up there. And
My name is Ray Thomas, and I'm with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance Legislative Committee, and I have materials for all of you. For 20-plus years, I've been a student of Oregon traffic law. I've written two legal guides about bicycle and pedestrian law that are relating to Oregon laws, appeared before many of you before on bicycle issues, and I'm proud to say that we're all here for the same reason, and that is we believe that the laws are important, that the laws should guide our citizens in a safe way, and when we see all of us a law that is being universally or almost universally disregarded, we don't like it. And the reason we don't like it may be because it's something that, like the stop sign law, the folks who are violating it seem to think that it's okay to violate it, and we don't have, and let's be clear and honest here, we don't have sufficient law enforcement resources in the state of Oregon to prosecute each and every stop sign violation. And in fact, if you talk to law enforcement officers, you will find that while they recognize that not only in Oregon, but throughout the world, where there are stop signs that apply to bicyclists, they are almost universally disregarded. The fact is that if you look at what the causes are of collisions, it's not where bicyclists fail to realize that they have to stay out of the way of a motor vehicle. It's not because they fail to honor the stop sign. It's because they make a mistake about when it's safe to go. It's the same reason that kids make a mistake and get hurt when they step off of a curb at a crosswalk. They've made a mistake about when it's safe to go. This law is not going to legalize stupid behavior. And in fact, what it does is it makes dangerous behavior where people sail through a stop sign and fail to yield to approaching vehicles 50% greater in terms of fines. And what it does is it frees our law enforcement officers to enforce those violations at those intersections which are actually dangerous. And in fact, it's people who are entering intersections and failing to yield, those are the ones who are dangerous. And it's unusual in Oregon for us to come before you and to talk to you about some innovation that we want to take in the law where we have an example that has been in effect for 27 years in a sister state and where a track record has been established such that we can have police officers, traffic engineers, telling us about what that experience has been. And the reason that it's a lucky thing, perhaps, in this case, even though this body passed this law, the House passed this practically identical law in 2003, the reason that it's maybe a lucky thing is because stop signs and bicyclists, in the minds of many, are somewhat of a sore point. And the fact is that as a lawyer, I talk to juries all the time about bicyclists. And what I want to do is to find out what makes people mad about bicyclists. And one of the main things that motorists say is bicyclists who run stop signs. But if you take a look at the causes of the collisions, what you find, it's not that the stop sign does or doesn't make an impact on whether the collision happened. It's that the bicyclist made a mistake about when it was safe to go, because no bicyclist ever decides to ride out in front of a car, or to use a NASCAR term, to engage in rough driving practices with a motor vehicle. Nobody does it. So this is a situation where I believe we have a chance to really take a look at something that is a law that's different from the law that applies to motor vehicles, the Idaho style. But we have a chance to see whether this is something that actually serves our purposes better. There are some laws for bicycles, because they are vehicles, that are the same as for motor vehicles. Bicyclists are supposed to yield to pedestrians, and they should. The fact that they don't is a problem. We need to have law enforcement enforce ORS 811.028 that this legislature or the previous legislature clarified to enforce those pedestrian rights against all vehicles, including bicyclists. But we also have laws that apply to bicyclists that are different, because bicycles are different. For example, people under 16 to ride a bike, by law, have to wear helmets. These are laws that are different. They are applied to bicycles because bicycles are different. And stop signs for bicycles are different than they are for cars, for the reason that bicyclists are not going to blow a stop sign and run into a bus full of crowded kids. It doesn't happen. And in fact, what we see when we find folks in emergency services and law enforcement who have to clean up the mess when a bicyclist makes a terrible mistake and gets hurt or killed, this is behavior that is not going to be made legal or illegal by this law. It's not going to be changed by this law, except to make it so that if a police officer sees a group of bicyclists or a single bicyclist cutting in front of a car, blowing through a stop sign, failing to yield, they're going to be able to give that bicyclist a ticket that's going to be 50% greater in severity than the present stop sign law. And in fact, if you look at the materials that I provided to you, I think you'll see that we have good company in looking at the law that the House felt was a good idea in 03, because it's even a better idea in 09, because we have six more years of this law having been in place in Idaho with excellent results. And the materials that I provided to you include a letter from Terry Little, who's a traffic services manager in Idaho. And he says he's been a professional engineer for over 30 years, and he believes that the law in Idaho allows bicycles to do what happens in most cases anyway, and that it makes it so that it actually improves the transportation system. The second letter is from Idaho's senior transportation planner, Mark McNeese, who's been their pedestrian and bike coordinator since 1996. And what he says is that the first question that you're going to want to have answered is, how many bicyclists have been hurt as a result of allowing bicyclists to yield and roll through stop signs when there's no approaching traffic? And the answer is none. Because what has happened is that the yield has not changed. And so what Idaho did was actually conducted a study, which is the fourth attachment, which was conducted by the University of California School of Public Health researcher Jason Meggs. And what he concluded was, and this was a longitudinal study, included interviews with folks from Idaho who in 1982 passed this law with some of the same questions and misgivings that you have today, such that when they passed the law, they included a child education provision as a part of it, because they were concerned that children might not be able to intuitively understand how the new law was going to have application. And what they did was, in 1986, after they studied the fact that there was absolutely no change in injuries or fatalities for bicyclists, they eliminated the safety education proposal and widened it to safety education for all bicyclists about the important traffic laws. Why? Because the fact is that children intuitively understand that you're not supposed to ride your bike or walk, for that matter, out in front of a car at an intersection. Nobody intends to do that. The reason that we apply different rules for kids is not because, for example, at a crosswalk intersection in Oregon law, a child has to stop at the curb before crossing in a crosswalk. The reason we teach our kids that they should stop at the curb, regardless of having the right-of-way in a crosswalk before they cross the street, is because they don't have the biologic equipment yet and the judgment yet to be able to cross safely. So we apply a special rule for them until we as parents decide that they're adequately equipped and mature enough to be able to cross. And then maybe we say, hey, you don't have to stop at every corner. If there's no cars, come and go ahead. But we do that with bicycles, too, and tell them oftentimes, before you cross, you better stop at every corner. The fact is that if you take a look at the study that the Professor Miggs created, what you'll see is that in Idaho, while they've had this law since 1982, they have not resulted in any more injuries for bicyclists. And in fact, he conducted a comparison between Boise and Sacramento, two states alike size, and determined that in fact, for the reasons that are included in the study paper, the Idaho-style stop actually makes it more safe for bicyclists for a number of reasons, one of which is that bicyclists are not in a situation where they get stuck and overtaken from behind by cars that are approaching them and are where drivers are unsure whether the bicyclist is going to go or not. There's also for you a paper that I wrote that I hope you'll find helpful, which is Are We Ready for an Oregon-Style Bicycle Yield Law, that I placed at the back. And what it includes is reference to a study that was conducted, and I think Carl Rohde referenced it in his remarks, by a physics professor who looked at what it takes for a bicyclist to actually do the starting and stopping that's necessary to lawfully comply with all stop sign laws. And as you might suspect, it's considerably inefficient to have to do it because most folks can't do a track stand and stop. They have to put their foot down. And going through that is laborious. It's not a public safety hazard to have to do it, but it's just one more thing that we do trying to put a square peg in a round hole in terms of making bicycles act like cars. And I think it was Representative Benz who asked about, well, why not electric cars? Well, the thing is, there's one fundamental difference between electric cars and bicycles, and that is electric cars, unlike bicycles, are as wide as regular cars, or maybe they have a narrower width of track, but basically they're in a situation where as slow-moving vehicles, they've got an entirely different set of laws that apply to them than bicycles. Because what do we do as bicyclists? We share the lane with the cars. We share the same lane. We're not in a situation where we're expected to take the lane. And in fact, one of the laws that is a special law that applies to us as bicyclists is that we can take the lane until when? We can take the lane until we start to slow the cars down. And when we start to slow the cars down, we have to move as far to the right as practicable. That's the law in the state of Oregon. And another law that is a special law for bicyclists, but it's one of those laws that makes it so that when a bicyclist is clogging the street, they're actually violating the law. So what this law does, and this is something that was studied by the Bicycle Transportation Alliance before we proposed this to you, what it does is it makes it so that, and a police officer from Idaho, I think, who has his materials in here, I think it's maybe the third attachment for you, his name is Bob Egan. And what he says is that our laws should reflect societal norms and should be reasonable enough that the average citizen is likely to follow them. I'm not a fan of laws that are unreasonably strict and widely ignored and then not enforced. Nowhere on earth, and I've biked across a good deal of it, and this is true even in Germany, do bicyclists come to a full stop, even at stop signs, when there's no traffic coming. And then he says is that my view is that law enforcement should be performed in a way that encourages people to get out and exercise and become part of the community. I like the Idaho laws because a biker can act normally in front of a cop. As a bike cop, I like not being put in a position of having to enforce laws that I would not follow when out of uniform. One of the things that we want to do, all of us, is to have it be that the laws are relevant, that they make sense. And when the laws are in a situation like Oregon stop sign laws, where a sister state has, since 1982, had 27 years of experience creating a law for bicyclists that allows them to approach, slow, yield, and roll without an increase in traffic collisions or injuries or fatalities, it gives us an opportunity to take and really to put ourselves into that position we've been in for many years, which is leading the field in terms of the Oregon Vehicle Code being looked upon by people in other states as an example of what folks do when they try to have an integrated traffic system that includes human and non-human powered vehicles. And if you take a look at our work in the legislature with the bike lane laws, with our pedestrian laws, with our vulnerable user laws, with the way that we've made the bike lane laws evolve over the years, we've been a national model for these things. And Mr. Miyazaki will talk a little bit about that, too. So I'd encourage you to take a serious look at this, to take a look at the materials that we've provided. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about it.
Thank you. And I have about 8 more people on this bill and technically have another bill to do today. So, and I don't want to cut people off, but I want to make sure that we try to move along a little faster. So thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'll be very short. Most of what I intended to say has been covered or raised as a question by someone on the committee. So my name is Bob Mayansky. I'm a former Olympic bicycle racer and national champion. I am now an attorney in Portland. I represent exclusively cyclists and have done so in my practice for over 10 years. And so I have a lot of experience with the issues that we're talking about today. Additionally, I've been writing a column on bicycle law in a national magazine for nearly 10 years, and soon I'll be writing for Bicycling Magazine. You may have seen that in a dentist's office or something like that. And we cover these kinds of issues, and I get a lot of feedback, and I invite questions from my readers. And I wrote an article on this issue a few issues back, and I had a lot of responses, and they were overwhelmingly in favor of this. Now, that might be natural because they were mostly cyclists, but I also have inquiries from the governor's office of Wisconsin and Iowa and several state representatives in Colorado and a number of politicians in California, and they seem to be very interested. They look at Oregon as a leader in transportation, especially as it pertains to vulnerable users and mixed modes of transporting ourselves in the system. And so they're all waiting to see what's going to happen. My view is that, and having raced and trained in Europe, South America, Asia, and some other countries, Oceania, New Zealand, I've encountered all different traffic rules, you know, where people are riding, you don't know what the rules are, riding against traffic, and all these different kind of chaotic scenarios, including in Europe where we have a little bit of a separate system for bikes, and in Italy where there is no separate system. And what I've noticed and what I believe is that this is a good bill, the bill that's being proposed, and I think it will work. And I understand that there are some considerations, some concerns, especially when you read the language and you consider what the effect may be on children. But I would note that we have a lot of uncontrolled intersections in Oregon. Maybe you've driven through some of them yourself. I bet less than a third of the population knows what the rule is. And yet, what we're talking about here is a bright line, is saying this is what the rule is. You're basically treating a stop sign as a yield sign. We have yield signs everywhere. If somebody violates a yield sign right now and causes a collision, they have no problem discerning who to put the blame on. And it'll be the same case for cyclists if this bill can move forward. And so I'm here basically to say I feel I have enough experience and background to make a pretty decent judgment on this. I care about cyclists. I care about all members of the traffic population. But I believe that this bill will work, that it'll improve cycling. It'll improve transportation for everyone, because when more people ride, there's less congestion. And, you know, when motorists get irritated seeing a cyclist in front of them, what they don't consider is that that cyclist also owns a car, and he could be in traffic with them. So, Madam Chair, that's basically the only reason I appeared today. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise,
thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one real quick question. Since you've ridden around and you obviously know people's capabilities on a bike are dramatically different. I mean, from the time you are in shape to where you are, well, maybe you're still in great shape riding a bike. I mean, that's hard telling, but there's a difference. Do you think it'd be better if maybe we did sort of a licensing program for people to do this, where they actually had to go and take a test and set up a test through the DMV and go about it that direction and actually license people to ride their bikes on the road so they understand all the traffic hazards and understand what's going on with the automobiles, because automobiles are going to have to learn to adjust to bikes as well with new rules, because they have to understand that, and we're going to have to rewrite the driving test for drivers when they go in so they know what to expect.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I think that's a great idea, not necessarily to exclude this bill, but in addition to, in Germany, children learn about the rules of the road and bicycle safety from when they can start reading, and everyone knows and understands the rules. I don't believe that we're going to encounter a large confusion on the road as it pertains to this matter. I think it would be beneficial to see a video, possibly, of how this would work, or to go out and see a real world. You know, we're talking about this in an abstract way. In fact, if you read some of the statutes that pertain to other traffic laws, they're pretty bewildering. But when you get out in the car, you remember the first time you're introduced to driving, and you look at the manual, and you freak out. But then when you get in the car, you realize, okay, that's what they're talking about. And this is a case that I think would follow that example.
All right. Thank you. Next, I have Chris Warler. And is there someone else that was coming up? Yeah, Drix. Is that you? You want to come on up too?
Sure. Here, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to present some of my concerns as an amputee bicycle rider. My name is Chris Warlow. I live in Corvallis, and I've lived there for the past 40 years. And I lost a leg in 1956 when I was run down by a drunk driver in Southern California. It took 2 years after I lost the leg to be able to walk again, and I relearned to ride a bicycle, which was no easy task. So how do you keep an artificial foot on a moving pedal and pay attention to everything else that's going on while you're riding the bicycle? Well, I started using toe clips and took and put a strap behind the foot, and that would keep the foot on the pedal. But in doing this, when you're riding a bicycle and you have to come to a stop and you got one foot strapped into the pedal, the other foot doesn't touch the ground. So you have to find a curb to be able to stop. Well, some of our intersections don't have curbs. It makes a lot of sense to me to be able to do a rolling stop. I see that there's no traffic coming, I can go on ahead. Another issue that when you're riding with an artificial leg, you can't stand up and pedal. So every time you come to a stop, that foot has to go down. But how do you get off the seat? Okay. I finally found that if I used some deeper toe clips, I didn't have to put the strap behind the heel. But every time I would come to a stop, I have to pull the foot out, okay, and then I start riding again. I can put a foot on the right toe clip, but I got one hand on the pedal, one hand on this leg, trying to put it back into the clip. Am I paying attention to traffic, or am I paying attention to getting that foot back in the pedal? So anyway, a lot of these things are difficult to do. It makes far more sense then to me to be able to slow down at non-busy intersections, check for traffic, see if it's safe to proceed, and then continue. However, this means that I'm breaking the law. I don't like to break the law, but I'll have to admit that I'm going to continue to do so because it's far safer than it is to come to a complete stop at every intersection. So I urge you to consider passing a bill that allows bicyclists to legally proceed through posted stop signs without stopping if it's safe to do so. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Any okay. questions?
I don't see any right now, so maybe before you get down, well... Go ahead, Drix, right?
Yes, thank you, and good luck to you. How do you do? My name is Drix, I'm real honored to be here underneath Goldie, our pioneer on the roof of the Capitol building, and sharing my ideas with our Regan. And thank you. My ideas are pretty much just to add to what everyone else has said and maybe point out some just views of things people haven't thought of. The future, which we're coming up really fast here, is not full, but it's just going to be a different kind of future, and we need to just make plans to work with it a little better. It seems here our decision is so much not stop and go, but stop and slow. These people before me all had a very valid point that on a bicycle, you've got two things going for you, velocity and thrust moving forward, and balance, which electric cars don't have. And that balance gets to be a real bear when you have to slow down, and I never knew the word a track stand before, but we've all seen the real talented people can wiggle their wheel and not fall over. But it's a bear to have to stop and start and start. But I don't think anyone's running through lights. You stop at the ones you need to, the ones you do, but it's just the variables, though, the ones that are just, it looks safe, you slow down, you look both ways, you wear your helmet, I always do. As a reference from another whole place, I lived in Los Angeles for, I keep trying to leave Oregon, but it's just so great here. I mean, you all probably know that too. In Los Angeles, they have a thing called split lanes. I don't know if you've heard of it, but you have motorcycles and then you have lots of cars. And it's legal there, and talk about a new idea, to be on a motorcycle and go between the lanes of the cars. And I call that BBs and marbles. You can have a bowl full of marbles, and you can still pour a bowl full of BBs in there, and somehow it fits. You just shake it around, and it works. Yeah, you're terrified splitting through those lanes on a motorcycle, but you do move forward. It does move the people, the data packets, the people packets, as it were. I'm a kind of computer geek here. But, yeah, it does make it work, and it's a new idea. And the thing with new is it's only new until it's not new anymore, and then usually it becomes a good idea. So this whole concept is new, and it's fresh, and it's pioneer spirit that's causing us to even think it. And then I guess I'll follow up. How am I doing so far?
You're okay.
I'm not an attorney, so I'm not so many. Yeah, I've got my big finish here. That's what I wanted to check. but I think the big thing we're talking here is integrity. It's not really a bicycle word, but maybe it is. A lot of bicyclists pass things back and forth in a moment, and you pass on the knowledge and wisdom of not going through. With kids, you teach integrity. And with bikers, they have this. In Eugene, we bike all over. We bike on both sides of the Willamette, and then we send the river to you here in Salem. And it's a future that's coming on. The Chinese had bikes for a long time, and now they're coming to cars, and we seem to be going the other way. But I encourage all of you to have all your views, but I guess I just thank you for letting me be here and say something. And next time I'm rolling through a stop sign, I'll think of you all, and thank you for the democracy we have.
Any questions?
I don't know. Are we done?
I think so. I don't see any questions. Thank you.
Said it all.
Evan and Russ, Bob Russell.
It's a hard act to follow. Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, Evan Manvel. I'm here as a private citizen, not representing any particular organization. I do have over a decade experience in traffic issues and was a former director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, so know bicycle issues quite well as well. I'm in support of House Bill 2690. Three main points. I think it'll improve safety. Making cycling easier means more people do it, and more people cycling means that drivers and other people who use the road look for cyclists. And we've seen this as a data. It's very clear over the last 20 years in Portland, we've seen approximately five times as many people bicycling, the same number of people getting crashes, which means the crash rate has fallen dramatically over the last two decades. Frankly, people start looking for cyclists, and they start to expect them. So if we can do things that make cycling easy for everyone and remove any impediments, that's going to make it safer for everyone. Second point on safety, I think my friends talked about, we have to focus our traffic police resources on dangerous things, not things that aren't dangerous. When I was at the BTA, the police department was diverting up to 6 traffic officers once a month, enforcing stop sign laws, often on residential streets that had no records of crashes for bicyclists. And so those traffic officers weren't out there dealing with speeding cars. They weren't dealing with drunk drivers. They weren't dealing with anything. Second reason to support it, equity. About 1 million Oregonians cannot drive. They are too young, they are too old, they are too poor, or they are too infirm to drive. These people end up biking, they get pulled over, they get a $242 ticket for something that is safe. And that's a really big impact on someone who's young, someone who's poor. Third reason, I think it'll improve police-community interaction. When we focus our police resources on things that are actually dangerous, cyclists will be much better, much more okay with that. Definitely deal with a lot of blowback against the police when they see laws that don't seem to make sense being enforced and getting large tickets for that. So those are the three reasons, and I just want to say I appreciate the chance to testify, and it's time the laws of Oregon acknowledge the laws of physics.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and it looks like I may be the only one testifying with concerns about this bill today. It's not that the trucking industry does not support cycling. We strongly support cycling. Matter of fact, the more people that bicycle, the less single-occupancy vehicles are on the road and the more room there is for trucks. So bicycling is a good thing. However, safety is the number one priority to my organization. Last session, there were two major bike bills. One was the vulnerable user bill, and the other one had to do with passing bicycles on higher speed facilities. We supported both of those and thought that they were excellent pieces of legislation. We also supported the bicycle share the road plate, and we actually paid a portion of the cost of the bicycle share the road plate. So we've been working closely with BTA for a long time, and we've enjoyed that relationship. And I think all of the bills that they have introduced this session, with the exception of this one, are just fine with us. Sort of where we come from on this one is sort of two issues. It's one of expectations. Those folks that are in the vehicles sort of expect everybody that's sharing the road to operate with the same set of rules. And if a vehicle doesn't, it sort of confounds everything and causes confusion, and often that leads to difficulties. The second thing is judgment. The way this bill is written, it requires a person to make significant, if they're on a bicycle, to make significant judgments on whether they can go through the stop sign or whether they actually have to stop. And some folks are going to make that judgment just fine. There are others that are not. And earlier we were talking about children. Folks are immature because they don't make good judgments. And I worry a lot about children being able to go through stop signs and being required to make these kinds of complex judgments about when they can do that. So the way the bill is written, I think it is very broad in that it applies to all facilities. It applies to all stop signs and all bicycle users. And I think that based on that, I think it's a significant concern to my industry in terms of safety. We don't like to mix it up with bicycles. We support bike boulevards. Those are very good things. So I'm going to stop there and answer any questions you want.
Excuse me, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, it seems to me that there are two, just having seen this whole issue in the last couple of days, there may be more of these, but as a person is approaching the stop sign, it seems like there's two things they need to do. One, look and see if there's somebody coming, and two, see if they can beat them across the road.
Right.
Those two things. Are there more?
You know, the way this is written, it says that you have to see if the vehicle is close enough as to constitute an imminent hazard. That's one of the judgments. So, yes, you're trying to see if you can beat it across. And you fail that if you fail to exercise care to avoid an accident. So you're absolutely right.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So the way it is now, supposedly we reduce that choice to one, and that is you stop and you see the car, and now you know it's there.
Right.
And then you see if you can beat it across by starting out more slowly. So have we? I guess I'm trying to get at what the baseline is. Is the baseline that we're always going to roll through it, or is the baseline that we're going to stop?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, you know, I think the expectation is that everybody stops. The problem with rolling through it is the other vehicle person or whoever's sharing that intersection doesn't expect that vehicle to roll through it. And rolling through it, depending on the speed, you have less time to make the judgment of whether you can make it across without having a collision with the other vehicle.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for you, Bob, and your information that you're not the only one who isn't in support. We actually have written testimony from others who are not in support of this bill. Because I think everybody here would recognize that Eugene's probably one of the bicycle-friendliest cities to ride in. So they have lots of bike paths, but the city of Eugene is not supportive of this bill. So you're not alone.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Jaffe and Brock Howell. And Scott Winkles, do you want to come on up? Are you here? Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Jaffe. I'm representing the city of Portland. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this afternoon on House Bill 2960. I know you've heard a lot of testimony, so I'll keep my comments brief. The city of Portland is taking a neutral position on this bill. I understand there may have been some confusion regarding our position following an article in today's Oregonian, which highlighted the police bureau's concerns. Portland is committed to promoting cycling as part of a comprehensive transportation plan, and we're really proud about our vibrant and robust cycling community. Our investments in bicycle transportation infrastructure and promotion of cycling is an important mode of transportation have been recognized throughout the country and the world. As a result, our investments, we have seen double-digit bike growth in bike use for each of the past 4 years. And our annual city auditor report finds that 8% of Portlanders identify bicycles as their primary means of transportation, and an additional 10% identify bicycles as their secondary means of transportation. As stewards of a diverse multimodal transportation system, we must ensure the safety of all transportation users, from pedestrians to cyclists and motorists, equally. Thus, any confusion regarding the city's position is a result of the complex set of issues this legislation presents for local governments. We must balance the needs of a diverse multimodal system that incorporates bicycle transportation as well as the public safety of all users. We're committed to the safety of cyclists and have made important improvements in cycling safety by installing bike boxes at dangerous intersections and closing intersections that cannot be made safe. While concerns have been raised, we've also heard that this law could result in the increased safety of cyclists, and this is something we're looking into and working with our traffic division as well as the Portland Department of Transportation, Portland Bureau of Transportation, and looking into how this bill has worked in Idaho as well. I'd like to express our support, our appreciation for Representative Bailey and the other legislators working on this bill and their commitment to bicycling issues as an important transportation mode, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Don't see any questions coming. So, Brock.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I represent Environment Oregon. And I'm representing our 30,000 members and to protect clean air, clean water, and open spaces. And why we're engaged right now in this is not obviously a high priority. We have other bills that we're working on daily. But the reason for this is we believe we need to move our transportation system towards more multimodal, more alternatives, so that way we reduce our impact on global warming, as well as creating more vibrant communities. And so I think this is a key component to ensuring that we create the better communities for the future. I would like to address a couple of issues with this particular bill of why this is important. One is, again, the basic physics of bicycling. Being clipped into a bike coming to a stop is very difficult to be able to clip out. If those of you have tried it, and especially if you have old clips like I do, it becomes even more difficult. So it's very essential as far as safety is concerned when you come to the stop to be able to have a method to get through the intersection in a safe way. And a lot of times the safest way is not to clip out and put your foot down, but to come to a rolling stop or to not a rolling stop, but to roll through and assess your situation, determine what is the most reasonable approach to get through, and then to go through. And so as far as safety is concerned, we believe this is the better approach. With regards to the law, as I mentioned, there's been some concern about how we treat bikes versus cars, whether it's equitable to do this. The current infrastructure is built designing solely for cars. When you're on a bike in the current infrastructure, it's a very strange feeling to be dealing with normal traffic laws when your bike can do different things than what cars can do. The safety requirements are different. So cars, for example, have to meet certain safety requirements that don't take into account their impact on a bike. They have to do with the impact with another car. And so when a biker is going on a road, their consideration for their safety is much different, and they take that into account. So as we look at this law and how it sets up of what the reasonable biker approaching an intersection is concerned with, I think the better approach is to have that question. What would a reasonable biker do at the intersection? Not a bright line rule of you must stop, but what's most reasonable. And I believe this law will help us achieve that. If you have any questions, I'm happy to take them, but thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any questions, so Scott.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkle is representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I am here to express the League's concerns with this piece of legislation. Besides being a lobbyist for the League, I'm also a cycling enthusiast, and I clip in, and I do appreciate the frustration of coming to a stop sign, having to wrestle my foot out of my clips, and then proceed on. But I also recognize that the stop signs are placed for a reason. In fact, stop signs in intersections in general are designed by traffic safety engineers for the express purpose of protecting the safety of the public. If the traffic engineer felt it was safe for a vehicle to yield to traffic, that's the sign that they would use. But when a stop sign is placed, it's usually done after a great deal of study and done by a person who is educated in how traffic works, and it's done in the interest of the public. Secondly, our concerns are based on, probably best illustrated by Sir Isaac Newton in Principia Mathematica, objects in motion tend to stay in motion. A bicyclist that enters into an intersection... A bicyclist that enters into an intersection committing an Idaho stop and then realizes that that was not the best choice for him or her would then need to change their course of action. A bicycle does not stop on a dime just as a car doesn't. It's determined based on a lot of things, friction of the road surface, tire, whether you're riding road slicks or whether you're riding mountain bike tires, and in my case, the weight of the rider. If the bicyclist would still proceed even though they've determined that it stopped, even though they've now applied the brakes. We feel that this is an incredibly unsafe situation. The third reason is for that the league's identified a concern with this bill is that it doesn't distinguish between a bicyclist riding on their own and a bicycle who might have a child in a burly trailer or in a bicycle seat. We feel that that would be an unsafe practice and don't believe it should be sanctioned in law. I do want to address a couple of points that were brought up in earlier testimony. The first is the study in Idaho is fascinating, but I would respectfully submit to the committee that bicycling behavior in Idaho and bicycling behavior in Oregon is significantly different. There's weather, population densities are going to impact that, and I don't know that a study done based on Idaho would necessarily translate to conditions in Oregon. And the point I would close on is that under the current statutes, a police officer has discretion as to whether or not they wish to issue a cite. If a police officer witnesses a person rolling through a stop sign and determines that it was safe, that officer is under absolutely no obligation to issue a citation, and I would submit in most cases they probably don't. And with that, I would conclude my testimony and would welcome questions.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Winkles, do you have any studies to back up your assertion that cycling in Idaho is different than in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, that is conjecture based on my knowledge of population and my own travels in Idaho.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
And in your statement that traffic engineers do studies to determine which traffic control device is most appropriate to give an intersection, do traffic engineers split traffic into various modes to consider different kinds of devices for different modes of transportation, or do they consider traffic as a flow or for the modal vehicle that goes through, that is, the most frequent vehicle?
Madam Chair, Representative Beyer, my understanding is the traffic engineer would look at the totality of the circumstances of the intersection and look what's best based on pedestrian use and vehicle traffic as well.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. So is it correct to say then that a highly educated traffic engineer, such as doing these studies, it is possible that that engineer might come to a different conclusion if they were allowed to have multiple rules applying to different modes of traffic in that intersection, but they are currently unable to have that apply to a given intersection? Is that a possibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, that is a possibility.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you, gentlemen, for coming to testify. And that was all we had on this bill. And as much as I guess my only comment and on the issue is that I've received some emails from people around the state, constituents, and let's just say their reading of this is not the same as we're getting more information today and a clearer picture of what this is and what it does, but the public doesn't have the benefit of that. And so the messaging around something like this, it gets challenging, and the public is just going to kind of see this as that they're the bicycles go again, wanting to go ahead and be able to do what they want and not pay any attention to the laws. And while I understand the arguments that we're getting here, I have to think about the messaging, and I don't know if that's something that you are thinking about at all as we go forward on this. Is, you know, how I don't, and based on the language in some of the emails, I am not so sure these people are going to listen to us anyway as we try to message them. So that I just want to raise that concern out there, is that there's a real public relations issue on this bill. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. Oh, yes.
May I make one final comment?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to say for the record that I believe that it is unfortunate and very unfortunate that a minority of cyclists have behaved poorly in their choices in cycling. And it is my belief that a lot of the confusion about this bill stems from some poor practices on behalf of friends of mine and fellow cyclists. So I appreciate that public relations concern.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, on the licensing bill from the bike community, I got a lot of emails about how, in our efforts to try to attempt to reduce carbon emissions, that we should actually pay them to ride their bicycles. And I would support that if the cities paid them prevailing wage to do it.
Madam Chair. Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, just while we're setting the record straight, I should mention that Idaho does have an Olympic cyclist that I think won a gold medal. So I think there's more than there's at least one very fine cyclist in Idaho.
Representative Call.
Just on the messaging, I think that there is a way forward on this, and I think that the message moving forward should be that cyclists want to get off of the high traffic roads. They want to be, as much as cars may be frustrated with cyclists sharing the roads, especially on those roads where there's lots of traffic, cyclists are equally as frustrated. And what this law, and why I support this law does, is it puts cyclists on the roads with less traffic and gives them the convenience of a thoroughfare on a road with less cars. And so I do think that there's a way to talk to the car people and explain to them that what this bill actually does is removes a headache, as they perceive it, from their commute and from their driving. And I think that that's a plus. So I do think that how this has been brought out thus far has been potentially divisive, and I have gotten those email that tend to reinforce an idea that bicyclists are out for some sort of special privilege. But I do think that there is a succinct way forward on this, and I'll just go back to what my brother-in-law said. You know, the minute we started talking about it, he was like, now wait a minute, does this mean I'm not going to have any more of those bicyclists right in front of me up Division or Hawthorne? And I was like, potentially. And he was like, this is a good bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2690. We're running out of time, and I wanted to see whether or not I recognized most of the names on the list for House Bill 2971, but there was one I don't recognize, and if it's it's Zelda? Zelada? And are you local, or did you?
I'm from Portland.
Okay. I'll go ahead and open the pub. Did you want to talk about this one, Phil?
Very briefly, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2971, but I'm going to take very brief testimony and carry this over till the 25th. Welcome.
Hello again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be very brief. This bill is intended to address some of the infrastructure concerns around bicycling infrastructure. We heard a comment during the hearing for the last bill that in Europe there are often segregated areas of streets or ways that are that streets have been improved such that bicycling is safer and more efficient. This bill would bump up from 1% to 2% the allocation for bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure, allowing for infrastructure that gets a very significant bang for its buck. And I think you'll hear in the testimony about the number of miles of paved bicycle paths that you could get versus a particular amount of highway interchange or of standard road construction. So this bill is about making our system more efficient, making it safer, and about getting that infrastructure that we heard about in the last hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. And I neglected to allow our good committee staff to explain what the bill actually did, and I don't know if you wanted to explain or if I want to let him explain.
Madam Chair, I'll leave it to the expert.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representatives, House Bill 2971 increases from 1% to 2% the allocation of state highway fund monies for footpaths and bicycles.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and call up Mr. Zelada. Is that what you? Yeah, Zelada. My voice is going. And we'll take your testimony, and then my apologies to everybody else if you don't mind coming back. Is it a problem? Well, come on up. Dr. Katrina Hedberg, take your testimony, too. So we got to be quick because they'll kick us out of here soon.
I'm at 6 minutes.
So I'm Dr. Zalata. I'm an optometrist from Portland. I'm also a longtime biker. I bicycled in 1975 alone from New York City to Illinois to knock on my grandfather's door, who promptly told me that I was a little crazy to do that. In 1982, I went from Forest Grove to New York City over the course of a summer. And so bicycling long-term is a big deal to me. And also, full disclosure, I'm a member of the OBPAC committee, which is the Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee to ODOT, appointed by Kulongowski. And I'm also on the legislative committee for the BTA in Portland. So I have a lot of ties. I have a lot of interests. The OBPAC committee, it does both bicycle and pedestrian things. This bill is probably one of the most hopeful kind of bills that you are facing, because it really gives a lot of push to dollars going to real communities. In the words of Roger Geller, who's part of PDOT in Portland, it's a cheap date. And this cheap date is really illustrated by this map. And the map you also have in your handouts that show each county, each district receiving monies directly from OPAC. So every portion of the 1% goes to a wide variety of communities. It gets in the hands of planners, and this is something that particular Chair Beyer, that we should tell Representative Boone, per location at 53 and Route 26, it needs one of these programs. We have a special light in Portland called the Hawkeye, and it does exactly what she complains about. It's a blind curve on Burnside. Pedestrians and bicyclists cannot get across knowing that they have enough time to get into the other side of the street if somebody's going 30 miles an hour. This establishes a push button. It stops the cars approaching the blind area, and we from OPAC gave money for that. So this is direct money to solve safety issues. The thing that I would ask you, I think I'm about 2.5 minutes, right? thing I would ask you is to think about where you were 5 or 10 years ago. Who would you, among you, would have believed that there were 12,000 or 13,000 people crossing the bridges as commuters? I mean, I think if we asked you 10 years ago, is this even possible? How do we get there? What infrastructure do we need? You would say, that's ridiculous. And I would ask you again, when is this number going to double? What year? Write it on a piece of paper. Send it to my office. I'll keep it. I'll contact you again. But just think, the escalation that was attributed in the other testimony, it's dramatic. It's not a tidal wave. It's not a tsunami. But it's coming, and it's very, and it's coming because of what OBPAC does. And to think about that, what PDOT in particular has done for those commuters are really several things. They've made arterials that are friendly to bicycles. They've made intersections that are calming for traffic. They've made workshops to teach people how to commute. They've made events to encourage that 60% of people that have bicycles in their garage but haven't used them in 2 years to get out, come across the bridge, get on the Fremont Bridge, look up the river, look down the river. So this is a tremendous infrastructure that we give money to. So the things that we don't get because we don't have enough money is that we normally give, my mind is blanking, trying to go too fast, somewhere here. We give two... Sorry, I've lost my place. We give, last session, we gave 17 grants out of 70 applications. And this has been roughly the same ratio for a number of years. So we've got a lot of communities from Oregon asking for more money, like Boone's necessary intersection. It seems like that would be a great program. We're not getting the dollars to them. In terms of use, if you look at your handouts, these are three places that failed. that didn't trigger out. The first is Coos Bay. You can see this is a main route two from the heart of the neighborhoods into downtown. Again, it's not a friendly place to walk. If you walk at night, you run the risk of being run over, especially if you wear dark clothes. The Coos Bay is another issue. Yahats is another issue. It's a tourist town, and again, when you look at the side streets, they do not have very comfortable places to park so that you can stop your car, go across the street, get a sandwich. Again, it becomes an economic development issue for those folks because people are not going to park very easily on this side berm, and people are not going to want to get out of the car and cross this highway.
There's a lot of... As we're all puzzling, I don't know that we got the handout. Did you give it to someone?
I put them together with you.
Sorry. So we need to. We're going to get kicked out. So we need to wrap it up.
All right. Well, I've got just a couple more paragraphs. The last one is the Shady Cove, which is. Another issue in terms of, you can see there's a picture of Shady Cove in the library. It's not very easy to go to the library and get a book on how to talk to your legislature. So there's no place to park. There's no place to walk. Again, you're on the side of the road and subject to perhaps being run over. So basically, these programs, the previous 1%, and also the perhaps 1% to 3% to 10% that does not get... committed funds are all these issues of interconnecting neighborhoods to the downtown, interconnecting economic development to places that need it. It's not just a Portland issue. So in terms of, again, thinking, doing a little sidebar on economics, the Outdoor Industry of America estimates that as a tourism, we receive $384 million a year. The tourism dollars come into Oregon. As part of that, we've also determined that 3% to 4% of tourists come to Oregon exclusively for bicycling. So that means $100 million, coming into our state, and they come here because we have the infrastructure, and we have the biking and pedestrian facilities. When you think about the Oregon Highway 101, the Coast Highway, the ODOT estimates that there are 4,000 to 6,000 riders a summer or during the season, maybe April to October. This means roughly $150 a day times that amount. You're talking about $2.4 million being spent in those communities. And this is just a lot of money. We would welcome, again, the cheap dates of having this 1% augmented to 2%, and let us build more infrastructure. So I know my grandfather's words that I was crazy. He would probably say, gee, the legislature is like looking in the couch for change. Where are the dollars? And he said, you're crazy for talking about increasing the money, but it's worth every buck. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr.
Zolada.
Yes, two doctors up there. Yes,
so thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the interim state epidemiologist with the Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here, and you have all my written testimony, so I won't go over all of that. But basically, as you're all aware, we have an obesity epidemic right now going on, not only in the United States, in Oregon. And it's a problem not only among adults, it's a problem among children, and it's not just, obesity really does impact not only health of people, but actual dollars and healthcare dollars that are spent in treating things like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. And very simply put, obesity is a result of too many calories in and not enough calories out. So we in public health are very supportive of whatever we can do to increase physical activity. There have been a lot of studies that show that if you increase infrastructure like sidewalks, bicycle paths, people will use them. People are often reluctant to go walking on the side of the road or biking if, in fact, it's dangerous for them, because clearly injury is something that we're also extremely concerned about. So, again, you have a lot of data in my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you. As you know, this is not in the governor's recommended budget. That's really the reason we would support this policy very much. But because of the fiscal constraints, we take a neutral position. So I'd be happy to answer questions. Again, I know we're short of time now, but I think you have my contact information as well.
Yes, so.
Yes, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just a quickie, just a little tick up in the governor's budget. It's proposed at 1.5.
Better so again, I can't address the fiscal.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead. Thank you very much, and I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2971, and we are adjourned.